This is Seattle's Morning News. Dave Ross with Colleen O'Brien. And we want to introduce you now to somebody who seems to have come up with the antidote to gang culture. His name is Anton Lucky. He's the author of A Redemptive Path Forward. And your story is amazing. You were born and raised in a South Dallas housing project. You got into the drug trade. Is it true that at one point you were making $3,500 a day?
Yes, very true.
That's over $1 million a year.
Yeah, it was back then. It was very, and I don't say this in glamorization, but it was very lucrative back then.
Let's go back to those pressures to join a gang, because I'm reading your story and I'm seeing that, yes, you grew up in a low-income, crime-infested area of Dallas, but you had this passion for learning and you had great grades.
Right.
And a lot of the times,
right,
you hear people say, well, I had my music or I had my teachers and my grades and that kept me out of gangs, yet you were still drawn in. So what was it for you that caused you to join a gang despite having that educational path forward?
So school and education was like very paramount for me because my father was in prison, sentenced when I was young. And so I put all my talents into education. I was A honor roll student, talented gifted student, the teacher's favorite. I was also my grandmother and grandfather's favorite. So I said to my cousins, listen, I said that and I meant that. But I was their favorite, and they praised me for the good grades that I was making, and I loved that. But no amount of praises and kisses and love was a match for what I encountered once I walked out my door in my neighborhood. Now, in my neighborhood, it was the idea was violence, the idea was surviving. So we would, going to school, we would fight kids just because we lived in a different neighborhood. And these kids were gang members. They had already identified as Crip gang members, et cetera, et cetera. The challenge for me every day was, you know, am I going to get to school safe? Am I going to make it home safe? Doing school, you know, navigating these kids who were already emerged in kind of gang culture. And so, you know, back then, and I'm quite sure it's true for kids now, you know, the smart kids, the intelligent kids, they get bullied. They get picked on. That's a reality that we deal with. And so for me, it was no exception for me. So I was, you know, as much as I tried to maintain my grades, you know, every day after school, the bus left at 3:47. And I don't care what part of the school you was in, if that bus left before you made it to the front, then you are left in enemy territory having to fight kids who just wanted to fight you for no reason. And so my focus went there. I had to navigate that. And so my grades started slipping because I was worried about my safety versus education. I was worried about how can I get home. And so these kids would fight us. And so eventually you say, someone may ask a question, well, how you become an accidental gang member? How you create a gang? Well, it's easy. You know, if you live in a community where you walk outside and somebody has on a blue sweater and they getting stomped to death by 15 guys in red sweaters, you know intuitively to go back in the house and put on a red sweater. And so that kind of was like the norm of the community in which I was growing up in. And so I eventually had to succumb to that. I had to amputate my personality just to survive. And so my days were filled becoming, I felt this duality of trying to remain good, but trying to fit in so that I wouldn't be bullied, so that I wouldn't be taken advantage of by the other area kids.
So that you could survive. So it doesn't sound like you had much of a choice but to join a gang, protect yourself, and try to get out of there. You ended up in jail instead. So then how do you come back to that community and tell kids who feel the same as you that they have no choice, that you actually do?
Right, and that's the whole purpose of my mission. I know that around this country there are kids who are talented, there are kids who are genius, who are in these communities that just bursting with ideas, but they'll get being suffocated by this idea of survival, this cultural idea, you got to be cuffed, violence, et cetera, et cetera. And so I remember me as a kid wanting and yearning for somebody, longing for somebody to come and navigate me and lead me through this terrain that was called my community, to get me to safer ground, and it never came. You know, I'm quite sure it was efforts, big brothers and sisters, clubs, that was in the community then, but they didn't reach kids like me. I didn't get that. I was unfortunate not to have someone who could mentor me. My mother worked long hours, et cetera, et cetera. So I wanted to be an example, and I wanted to provide a buffer for kids like that because they exist all over this community. A lot of times we judge them harshly because of what we see them doing, but we never just go a little bit granular to see why they're doing something. Because some of those kids are screaming for help. Some of those kids are just going along to get along. Yeah. And so if we had an effort that can lead those kids to say that education is way more important than joining the gang, that if you go down this road, I can pretty much predict what's going to happen to you when you go down this road. But if you choose this road, and I'm a living witness of going down that wrong road, but if you choose this road, then life will be better for you. And so that became like my modus operandi in terms of going back into communities, in terms of writing this book, because I want kids to know that you have a different choice. And I want to create mentors, those kind of mentors that got proximity to go back and reach those kids.
But before you changed your life, you were arrested. I mean, you were in numerous fights. You got a bullet wound. You had to go to prison. You had to go to school. Is there any shortcut, or does everybody have to take the journey that you took?
Oh, no, they don't have to take the journey. That's part of my message, that you don't have to take that journey, that you don't have to make those choices that I made, that you can choose to go the right path at the point that you're in right now. That's the message, and I make that very clear because I'm cognizant not to make the message seem as though you have to take this trip in order to be better. No, you can be better without having to take this trip. I remember when I was standing in front of the judge, and the judge was telling me that I was a menace to society, and then I had a conversation in my head that never came out of my mouth, but my conversation went like, "Judge, but you don't understand. You know, I'm from South Dallas, from East Dallas. It's a tough neighborhood, and that's not really me. I'm just really trying to get to where I need to be, and I have to do certainly." And that's the conversation that was happening in my head, but it was definitely not who I was. You know, I understood when he sentenced me, when he said that I was a menace to society, that wasn't who I was. And so from that point on, I became self-introspective as I was going into prison. I was retracing all the choices that I made. And one thing that I did in prison, going into prison, that I account for the change in my trajectory is I became accountable for every situation that happened to me. I retraced my choices, and I took responsibility for them. I didn't blame it on the system. I didn't blame it on the fact that my father went in the household. My mother worked long hours. I said I wanted to be fully responsible for the decision I made, and it's on me. It's on me, my decision-making process going forward, to make the best decisions to change the trajectory of my life.
Anton Luckey is the author of A Redemptive Path Forward, From Incarceration to a Life of Activism. Great to talk with you. Thank you.
Thank you, sir. Thank you. Thank you, man.
This is Yale's Morning News. Dave Ross with Colleen O'Brien, Chris Sullivan. Joining us, the host of CBS's Face the Nation, Margaret Brennan. I'm reading this morning that there might be some movement on gun control legislation. What are you seeing?
We're going to talk to Senator Chris Murphy of Connecticut about that effort that he's trying to lead. To be clear, the Senate is going on recess for the Memorial Day holiday, and they'll reconvene in June. Senator Murphy says that's actually something he hopes will help because you have senators going back to their home districts. Will they feel pressure there to do something when they return to Washington, or will this momentum dissipate? That's the big question. We know that there will be pressure to talk at least about federal legislation. The March for Our Lives movement, if you remember, that erupted among teen activists in particular who survived the massacre in Parkland back in 2018 at a high school there. Those activists will be returning to Washington in June. So we will see if it makes changes. The two things that are being talked about at this point are incremental. Senator Murphy would say that. He'd use that word. It has to do with background checks and red flag laws. There is no conversation at this point about, for example, a ban on assault-style weapons from being purchased.
What's your sense? Because it seems to me that with each mass shooting, we have another group of angry relatives who are not going to back down because their lives were changed forever. And at some point, I mean, we still have the Sandy Hook families are include a lot of activists. I mean, at some point, doesn't it reach critical mass where they can no longer be ignored even by Congress?
That is a question. And it's not just the question of Congress. It's whether the country can unify and create real pressure to act here. I think we've become disturbingly numb in some ways to the regularity of mass shootings. We are just a few weeks out from this mass shooting that was motivated by these racist theories where, you know, a grocery store shoppers were gunned down by a killer. And yet we're on to the next crisis here. And in this particular one, I think even for a country that's become calloused to this almost, elementary school children, I think the killing of them still takes our breath away. These 10-year-old kids, the pictures of them, as a mother, as someone who's covered some of these things, I mean, it's devastating. And I know I felt a weight on my chest dropping my son off at school. Yeah. I'm sure other parents feel that and that stress. So what are we doing to ourselves as a country, I think, is another conversation. The mental health anguish, the collateral damage to the first responders, to those who do survive. This is a trauma again and again and again, and it does deserve a real conversation. We're going to try to have it on Sunday.
Yeah, I see that the families are fighting back against this idea that, oh, it's too soon. You're trying to make political hay out of what happened. Well, yeah, I mean, we're a country that whose right. laws are depend on politics. It sounds to me, I mean, they're saying, no, this is the time to push Congress to do something and stop, you know, accusing us of being emotional. These are our kids. Of course we're emotional.
Right. Well, I mean, there's always that question of, is someone doing it for their own benefit or are they doing it for the public good, right? And sometimes when people throw around that term politics, that's what they're suggesting, that it's for self-promotion. For people who I'm going to speak to on Sunday, for two of the survivors, it is not about anything other than their hope to turn their losses into something to serve the greater good. Nicole Hockley, her 6-year-old son, was shot 5 times in Sandy Hook. She has become an activist. She has changed the laws in Connecticut, helped to change the laws in Connecticut, her home state, my home state. She's going to join us on Sunday. Jacqueline Corrin, one of the survivors from the Parkland massacre, part of that March for Our Lives movement, is also going to be with us. They did change laws in Florida state. It's at the federal level where there hasn't been really any meaningful and significant gun safety regulation in over a decade.
Okay. The other issue, Ukraine's been pushed off the front page by this, and now we're hearing that there's some Russia is making progress in the east, and Ukraine's become, President Zelensky's become more critical of NATO, saying they're sort of slow-walking weapons. Has the outlook changed from, you know, Ukraine being able to hold Russia off to Russia finally being able to win this?
I've never heard anyone say Russia can't dominate the battlefield at some point. What I have heard every U.S. official say is that this is a war of attrition. It is grinding. It will be not an example of great military prowess, but rather sending soldiers into a meat grinder and the willingness to be able to continue to do that and the arsenal that Russia has allowing them to continue to do it over a sustained period of time. And incremental is slow, but you can still get done what Vladimir Putin wants to get done in terms of actually gaining control of territory in the east. Now, there's that question of, can you swallow a country whole? Can you actually absorb these territories into Russia as he seems to want to do? That's a question of actual occupation. And that's the thing that U.S. officials are skeptical of.
The host of CBS's Face the Nation, Margaret Brennan. Thank you, Margaret.
Thank you.
It's time for your daily dose of kindness now. A little deep breath in the middle of your morning. It's brought to you by Heritage Homecraft. Feeling lost and stricken with grief 6 years ago when his wife passed away, a Minnesota man became a foster grandpa for an entire school. We get his remarkable story from CBS affiliate WCCO.
Kind of like being a big family, you know.
Today is Kevin McCarthy's first day of school.
or at least his first day back.
How you doing?
After months of cancer treatments. He's actually been a foster grandparent at Pine Meadow Primary School for years.
After a while, you get to know everybody.
When his wife died 6 years ago, Kevin was feeling alone.
We missed you.
So when he found out the school was looking for volunteers, he didn't hesitate.
Do you expect to like it as much as you've liked it?
No, I thought it would be more of a chore. And it wasn't at all. It was just every day, you know, when you leave, you feel good.
It's mostly the best game I ever played, and it's really fun.
Splash.
Before cancer, Kevin could get to 11 classrooms in a day, helping first grade teachers in all kinds of different ways.
Like you saw when he got here, everyone was like, oh, Grandpa Kevin. You know, he's a fixture here, and he's a big part of, you know, what we're doing here. So, yeah, the kids benefit greatly from everything he does.
He's really nice, and he's kind of funny.
He's nice, and I like playing games with him.
Kevin has logged 8,000 volunteer hours since 2016, providing countless math and reading lessons, as well as life lessons. During a time like this, those might be the most valuable lessons of all.
They don't miss much at all. People just kind of, you know, think that they don't know what's going on, and they know what's going on.
How are you guys doing?
So for these kids, nice, he's more than just a volunteer. He's Grandpa Kevin.
I probably get more out of it than the children do.
Isn't that sweet?
Yes, it is. Nothing like being a grandpa. And now it's 7:48 from the G and Ursula Show, which starts at 9 right here on Cairo News Radio. Here's G Scott. What do you think about the number of sports figures and coaches who have turned their pregame news conferences into basically gun control forums?
Love it. Absolutely love it. It's almost like if Colin Kaepernick were to do something again. You know what I mean?
Thank you. No, that's exactly what I leaned over and I said to Dave. I said, interesting how easy it is for them to take a stand on gun violence. But when it came to Black Lives Matter, so I really wanted to get your reaction, and it sounds similar.
Even though I say it's ironic, however, I love it. I love what the Yankees have done. I love what the Rays have done to use their platform to bring light to this, bring a spotlight on this, to help to cause change. And the discussion that I've been having with folks, because there's a lot of people that don't believe that anything is going to happen after what happened down there in Texas. And I disagree. I keep saying it because people say, well, you got to go in 2012, you got Sandy Hook, it would happen and nothing happened. Well, here's what's happened since Sandy Hook. There have been nearly 950 school shootings in the United States of America. And right here, right now, you had kids being killed again. Sometimes something about this country, I can't speak for other countries, this country, it has to really be shown things a lot. For an example, slavery. Like, what happened with slavery? Like, why did that end? Oh, this thing called the Civil War, where it's like 700 and some thousand Americans died here on this soil. It's like, okay, well, maybe. And then that even still didn't end slavery. But again, this right here, there will be change. I personally believe that's going to happen. By the way, I have to believe that way. We have to believe that way. Because if the one thing that we do, my dad used to always tell me this, you might not have anything. You might be struggling financially. Your health might be this. It might be all kinds of things going on. But there's one thing you can have is hope, right? And there's many generations of people, my ancestors that come before us that never had the mindset of, well, you know, there's not going to be change. Or, well, you know what? There's not going to be any women bosses out there. Well, women aren't ever going to be able to vote. You cannot have that mindset of, well, there's never going to change. Back to the Rays and back to the Yankees, they are helping with that change. And for them to use their platform to do that, I thought it was beautiful. It's never been done. And watch, it will continue now after that.
Hopefully.
Somebody's done it before now. Somebody's going to do it again. Every world's a copycat, you know, world, right?
Yeah. What's the reaction been? I haven't really paid much attention to the reaction to what they decided to do.
I mean, you still got those same folks that get on there and say it's people, it's not the guns. You still got those folks that got to get in there. But I got to tell you, those excuses are getting drowned out. Well, what about the good guy with the gun? Well, let's talk about the good guy with the gun. Those excuses, all those same talking points that you put them in the envelope and they pull them out every single time, they're getting drowned out right now. And so that's what's being said. More voices, more people are talking out. This is 2022 and not 2012. Everybody is on social media. Was TikTok around in 2012?
No. Yeah, actually, the young generation is a pretty powerful microphone. If you think about it, like we think we've got our microphones here, they can reach way more people than we ever could here on Cairo News Radio. So yeah, if the young generation, those students who are walking out of their high schools, if they take to social media and start putting the pressure on, which we actually saw out of the Parkland kids in Florida, David Hogg, I believe his name is, he's like a huge mover and shaker in a political movement now. Yeah. So
all those families, I mean, they put an organization together. That's what it'll take. You know, nobody's gonna shout down the survivors who lost their kids in these shootings, and we now have quite a few of them out there. You can't just dismiss them and say they're crisis actors. It is funny actually to watch some of the guys on Fox try to maintain this idea that it's not the gun. Even they are having trouble keeping a straight face.
It's tough, right? I mean, you look at the narrative, the storyline. How many times has the storyline changed down there in Texas from what happened?
Oh my gosh.
You want to know why? This is what happens when you try to tell the story and then cell phone video people's accountability of what's going on. Sorry, that doesn't match.
What do you always say, G?
The truth never expires.
There you go.
I mean, you know your boy, don't you?
I do, yes. You always keep your receipts too, my friends.
That truth, and, that never expired.
Texas is finding out how many people keep receipts as well.
Oh, so many receipts. Cell phone, video. Wait a minute. How long did it take for you to go inside of there?
That's, to me, is one of the hardest things to grapple with today is that those kids were in there quaking and scared for their lives for an hour, maybe up to 90 minutes, because the grown men in tactical gear were too afraid.
Do you think they would have wrote in the report that, oh, by the way, some of our officers went in to save their own kids? Do you think they would have wrote that in the report?
Right.
Nope.
It's sickening.
Yeah. But did that happen?
Apparently so.
Okay.
That's what we're hearing now.
You guys have a good morning.
G. Scott on at 9 with Ursula on Cairo News Radio. Seattle's Morning News. Let's listen to more from our conversation with Anton Lucky. He's written a book called A Redemptive Path Forward and has led quite a life. We talked to him ahead of his appearance at Seattle's Town Hall, but the national tragedy preempted the airing of that interview on Wednesday, which we had been planning. So we're doing it today. And his story is that he grew up as a gang member in South Dallas. He ended up going to prison. And when he got out, he returned home to get other kids out of the gang life as somebody who could talk with authority about that. So what changed him? What happened while he was in prison?
Prison in its current state is designed to break you spiritually, mentally, physically, your dignity, everything. That's the truth. That's prisoners at every turn in prison. It is designed to break you down to the lowest crumbs. I'm telling you, that's the intent. Rehabilitation and transformation, redemption, all that stuff, it has to be a private situation with yourself. It has to be something that you want. And you have, like for me, I made prison college for me. That was a choice that I made. I chose to study. I didn't play dominoes. I didn't do all the stuff that they did in prison. I chose to work on what got me in prison, and I began to work. And that was on me. And that's not to say that the influences of the officers, the inmates, and that whole culture became oblivious. No, it was there. But I had to make the choice. I read a book that changed my life, Viktor Frankl, Man's Search for Meaning. That's one of my favorite authors, man. And he described his experience in Auschwitz and talked about how when you find your why for living, then how is the easy. And so I compare my situation to him. If he could survive those concentration camps, I could survive prison by finding my why. And so it wasn't about the system. It was about me making the choice myself to say that I'm going to educate, I'm going to rehabilitate, I'm going to transform myself for me. And so, but prison want the catalyst for that. Prison is designed to break you. I make that clear. But no, I educated myself in prison.
Do you blame institutional racism for what happened to you growing up?
No, I don't. I blame the choices that I made. I blame every choice that I made, regardless of whether institutional racism or systemic racism played a part.
But, I mean, people would argue you don't have a choice. People would argue you don't have a choice when you grow up in an environment like that where you're constantly being traumatized by fights and gunfire.
You have a choice. And the reason why I say you have a choice and the reason why I don't blame systemic issues and institutional racism and all that stuff, because I know friends who grew up in the same community that I did, same neighborhood that I did, same family situation, et cetera, who did not give. For whatever reason, they did not yield to the influences. And they experienced them as I experienced them, you know, but they didn't give. They went the opposite way, you know, who are successful individuals in their life today. You can't, as you move forward, you can't deny that there are certain issues and certain things like redlining, but you can't allow that stuff to be the reason, the total reason why you can't move forward. Or you don't have upward mobility. It's personal culpability. You got to add that part in too to balance it out. I mean, I can say, well, hey, my neighborhood was redlined and the bank didn't give in, and so this wise came a community and all that. Just you can do that, but you got to put personal culpability in it as well. You know, you got to put the fact that some stuff, you make choices regardless if the situation is, you got to be able to make the right choices. So if you got the right information, you make the right choices. So you challenge that by making those choices.
So you've been able to successfully create relationships with local police officers down in Dallas.
Right.
What about the current gang members? I've heard that you can't leave a gang. And so I wonder how they feel about you coming into the community and taking away potential future employees.
I think most people in communities, most people in gangs are there just as the way that I was there. You know, they didn't grow up. They didn't come out. They didn't come out the womb with a rag on their head throwing up gang signs. They were good little babies, you know. They didn't know that. They was oriented and socialized that way, just like I was. They amputated their personality just like I did. And so all they looking for is someone who that they can point to and say, you know, if he did it, I can do it. You know, somebody that can lead them the way, because it's a lifestyle that you sometimes, when you in that lifestyle, you feel like you can't get out of that lifestyle when it's just as simple as opening the door and going through another door. But when you don't know that door exists, you know, then you feel claustrophobic, like this is all I have. And somebody else has to come, as I was saying earlier, I was alluding to earlier, somebody else has to come and say, look, I know this terrain. You know, it's a landmine. It's a landfill. And if you step right there, you're going to blow up. But if you walk right here, you're okay. But if you step right there, you're going to blow up because there's a mine up under that. Somebody has to do that for these individuals that's in communities and show them that way. It's a myth to think that they don't want something different. That's the wrong thinking.
Even the top dog gang leaders, they aren't trying to get to you or anything.
Oh, no. They want something. They are cheering for me. They're saying, man, I want to do that. And the question is, you know, even in prison, for a lot of men, when you spent the majority of your life under this ideology, and then now you're being challenged to change that, you know, that's a certain level of vulnerability you have to be willing to endure. We live in a society that say men can't cry.
Yeah.
You know, men got to be tough and macho.
Vulnerability feels like poison. Yeah.
Yeah. So what I tell them is this. I tell them that the vulnerability is really strength. Mm-hmm. See, I'm changing the way they look at it. See, they look at vulnerability as being weak because that's what society teaches. But I'm teaching them that vulnerability is where your strength is. That's when you become strong. So I'm itching them over on this part of the fence because I'm saying if you become vulnerable, if you're allowed to look yourself in the mirror, look in the mirror and really understand what it is that you want and understand that the lifestyle that you live in, you only have two things, death or prison. That's not hard for somebody to understand. It's just about being able to shed those layers of orientation that they have that's covering up the little innocent little boy that's in them. Everybody got an innocent little boy in them. They just, it's covered by layers. Mm-hmm. And so we got to unlayer those layers to get back to that vulnerability, get them back to their state, and then say, come on, let's put on these clothes. These clothes look better on you. Take that bandana off and let me put you on a blazer, on a suit that looks better on you.
Anton Lucky is the author of A Redemptive Path Forward from Incarceration to a Life of Activism. Great to talk with you. Thank you.
Thank you, sir. Thank you. Thank you, man.
In the nation's northwest corner is Washington.
Here it is Friday, and here he is, Felix Bunnell, our resident historian for All Over the Map, where he looks at the stories behind local places and things, and even roads. We're talking roads again. This one doesn't have the cachet of Route 66. Not as scenic as the Pacific Coast Highway, but it is US 395, which has its own underappreciated history.
So you can't get your kicks on US 395, but you can. It is worth the price of gas.
You can alive on 395.
Yeah, that's true.
There you go.
Last time I checked, it was worth the price of gas, but I haven't checked for a few months. To take a drive from Pasco to Spokane and then all the way to the Canadian border. Now, I've driven that Pasco to Spokane leg a few times. Haven't gone all the way north to Laurier on the Canadian border. I want to someday. There's an airstrip there that actually straddles the border. You can touch down your wheels in one country and taxi into another or vice versa. It's crazy. But I want to focus on the Pasco to Spokane section. On that drive, I go through towns of some of my favorite place names in the state, including Eltopia, which some people say is a variant of hell to pay for some difficulties faced by railroad crews in the area. You'll pass through the town of Lind, where the streets are named after the letters in the surname Nielsen, the family who platted the town. Although looking on the map, I can't find the second N, which makes sense. You couldn't have two N streets, right? Oh, but there is an N Street, I Street, E Street, L Street, all the letters in Nielso.
Very clever.
Yeah. And once you get to Ritzville, though, US 395 and I-90 are on the same roadbed all the way to Spokane. But you might remember last year we talked about how you can leave I-90 and go on old US 10 between Ritzville and Sprague. Now, what's really cool about the Spokane to Pasco leg of US 395... Before there was a highway, that was the original route of the Northern Pacific Railroad between Spokane and Tacoma. We finished that way back in 1881. So the first iteration of the highway didn't come until about 35 years later. But what's cool, many of the towns along there are sort of, they're born as railroad towns. And there's still old depots at Cheney, Sprague, Ritzville, and Lind. The first map I could find where the highway exists from Spokane to Pasco was 1915. At that point, it was called the Central Washington Highway. It was part of a 1913 statewide, state-funded effort to build what they called trunk roads. And the Central Washington Highway was the first of the batch to be completed. That happened in 1921 when the final 17 miles between Connell and Lind was improved. Total distance between Spokane and Pasco, 155 miles. And improved, they meant graded and surfaced with gravel and oil. The modern route now on 395 and 82 and 90 is only 135 miles. Now, that name US 395 was first applied around 1930. A map from 1933 shows the northern portion already called that, and the Pasco to Spokane section called Highway 11. By 1939, much of the route, which actually went from Mexico to Canada through California, Oregon, and Washington, was called 395. But I think based on a newspaper search, I don't think the number name really caught on until maybe as late as the 1960s. People were calling it Highway 11 or the Central Washington Highway. So. Nowadays, only the hoofbeats of the Iron Horse or a Lonesome Whistle or all that exists from that original route of what's now US 395.
Why'd they pick the number 395?
It's a spur of US 95, which goes a little bit farther east of there from Canada to Mexico through Idaho and Utah. And so they add a third number. It means it's a spur off the two-number main route.
Yeah. I'm still working a high five on 395, come alive on 395.
Or Central Washington Highway. That's pretty cool.
Price of gas used to be 395.
Yeah, exactly. The highway 695 now.
Yeah, yeah. Historian Felix Bunnell, All Over the Map.
You can ring my bell. Ring the bell.
Seattle's Morning News. So where does the burden fall when it comes to preventing the next school shooting? This is Cairo News Radio's Rachel Bell.
Since Tuesday's school shooting in Uvalde, Texas, a lot of people, including Governor Greg Abbott, have blamed the tragedy on mental illness. But Lauren Simmons, CEO of NAMI Washington, the National Alliance of Mental Illness, says that simply isn't true.
Violence is not a product of mental illness. Violence is a product of untreated anger. And the contribution of mental illness to overall gun violence in the United States is smaller than 2%. When we do see mental illness involved in gun violence, it's really gun violence against oneself. because more than 60% of gun deaths in the United States are suicides. And mental illness is a significant underlying cause of suicide. But mental illness is not an underlying cause of community violence.
She says there are many other warning signs we should look for.
The risks of violence increase slightly if one has co-occurring substance use or dependency, or if one grew up in a setting where there was violence, childhood abuse, or if they were bullied. Or quite honestly, another contributing factor is just being young and male. Are they isolated and young and male? Do they have impulsivity and anger issues? People have a really hard time understanding how could somebody walk in somewhere and shoot people and kill them? They must be mentally ill. What else could it possibly be? It's untreated anger, and anger is not a mental illness.
Lauren says this contributes hugely to the stigma around mental illness.
There can be the assumption that give us a gun, if we have a mental illness, we're likely to go out and kill somebody, and that is not true. So it definitely contributes to the stigma of having a mental illness and people's willingness to share that they have mental illness. And I think it's also important to note, you know, other countries experience the same amount of mental illness in their populations, and we don't see mass gun violence or even significant gun violence in other countries. And these are countries who, when they have had a mass gun violence incident, their leaders have created common sense gun laws, which is something that our leaders are unwilling to do. They have clearly accepted that guns are more important than the lives of the citizens of our country.
But she wants to be clear. NAMI does not advocate for gun rights. Lauren finds it interesting that gun advocates are using mental illness as a scapegoat, since it's a topic this country mostly ignored until the pandemic, when worldwide isolation affected nearly everyone's mental health. But before that, depression and anxiety was seen as a weakness by many.
Every time there is community gun violence in our country, we have been sending out press releases. So just a few weeks ago, we sent out a press release about the shooting in Buffalo, which was incredibly racially motivated. I didn't get one press call. Since I sent out our press release this morning, all I've done this morning is respond to press calls. So, you know, it just really depends upon what catches the media's eye at what time.
Lauren would like to see the media cover mental health more often, but not through stories related to gun violence.
Rachel Bell. And of course, the reason that the gun rights supporters go after mental health is because you figure, okay, well, all I have to do is cure mental health and we don't have to go after the guns. But we're finding out now through the research, statistics which have been withheld for many years because you couldn't get funding for this kind of research, that the gun is what makes the biggest difference. The marketing of it, the cachet that it has, yeah. The fact that it's proximate, the fact that it's close by at people's worst moments.
And we just heard from Hannah yesterday about our state's extreme risk protection orders, the ERPOs, that, you know, family members can remove firearms from the household of a family member who they feel is a danger to others or themselves, that once those firearms are removed and a year passes, there is evidence that individuals don't want their guns back because they recognized it as the thing that caused their anger to spill over and kill someone. So it's the guns.
Yeah. And the statistics now back that up. So we'll see how far this goes. Thanks for listening to Seattle's Morning News, the podcast. I'm Dave Ross.
And I'm Colleen O'Brien. You can find our podcast weekday mornings right at 9:30.
And if you subscribe, you'll never miss the Daily Dose of Kindness.